TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Ilan Pappé, Crisis in Zionism, Opportunity for Palestine, Part 2 of 2. UC Berkeley lecture by the Israeli historian held on October 19, 2023. This is the conclusion of a one-hour talk by Professor Ilan Pappé. He was born in Haifa in 1954 and served in the Israeli army. He became senior lecturer in political science at the University of Haifa and taught there from 1984 to 2007. However, after publishing his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine in 2006, Pappé was condemned in Israel's parliament and a minister of education called for him to be fired. Pappé became professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter, UK. Ilan Pappé's groundbreaking book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, revisits the formation of the State of Israel. Pappé offers archival evidence to demonstrate that from its very inception, a central plank in Israel's founding ideology was the forcible removal of the indigenous population. Between 1947 and 1949, over 400 Palestinian villages were deliberately destroyed. Civilians were massacred, and around 1 million men, women, and children were expelled from their homes at gunpoint. Many of the Palestinian refugees eventually ended up in Gaza, fenced in, unable to leave, and totally dependent on Israeli, United Nations, and international aid agencies for health care, water, food, fuel, and electricity. Before the current bombing campaign by Israel, 200 trucks with aid had to enter Gaza every day just to keep the population alive. In this part of his lecture at UC Berkeley on October 19, 2023, Pappé begins by explaining the role of Zionism in the current events.
The history lessons, so to speak, that is the antidote to dehistoricizing the events of the 7th of October and the events that are unfolding in front of our eyes today, and probably in the next few weeks, if not months, the historical context has, I think, two basic pillars. One is never to let go from our insistence of an accurate definition of Zionism. This is so important. You should not allow any discussion what goes on in Israel today or in Palestine today without talking about Zionism. And this is why, and it's not a coincidence, so much effort has been invested by Israel and its supporters in this country and in other countries to equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, that if you ever mention the word Zionism, you're already in a dangerous domain of being regarded as an anti-Semite, and therefore you will be ably be silenced. But that doesn't mean that this is not the only and right way to start the story. The story starts with an ideology which is racist, not to the history of liberation movements, which is how it is taught in most American universities, not to the history of national movements, as it being taught in most of the global north, or is talked about or covered by the Western media. No, it belongs to the history of racism, an ideology, not in its very origin, but in the way it manifested itself on the land of Palestine. And this racism is part of the settler colonial nature of the Zionist movement, namely a movement which is not exceptional, which you are familiar with in this country as well, of Europeans who were chucked out of Europe and had to find a different place to be Europeans in it, because they were not accepted as Europeans. And they found countries in which other people lived. And as the late Patrick Wolfe said in that encounter, the logic of the elimination of the native was activated the moment these settlers met the indigenous people. And that is true about Palestine as well. Eliminatory policies were the DNA of Zionist encounter with the Palestinians from the very inception of the Zionist movement in the late 19th century. To put it in less academic words, you wanted as much of Palestine as possible with as few Palestinians as possible. Eliminatory policies could be genocide, could be ethnic cleansing, could be apartheid. They take different forms in different places according to capacity, historical circumstances, and condition. But you cannot take out what happened in Gaza from these Israeli, and before that, Zionist eliminatory policies. Elimination of the native that began first in Zionist thought, in the drawing of Zionist painters, in the writing of Zionist thinkers, and became a strategy in the 1930s that was first implemented in 1948 in the ethnic cleansing of Palestine that ended with the expulsion of half of the Palestinians and the destruction of half of Palestine's villages. By the way, many of these villages are on the ruins of these villages. Some of the kibbutzim that were occupied by the Hamas for a few hours were built. These kibbutzim were built on the ruins of these Palestinian villages from 1948. And quite a few of the Palestinians who went into this kibbutzim were a third generation of Palestinian refugees from these very destroyed villages not far from Gaza. This is also part of the story. Not everything that I'm saying here means that I'm justifying everything that was done. No, I don't. But it means that it gives you an historical context without which you are not getting to the source of violence, and you're only dealing with the symptoms of the violence. And you need to go to the source of the violence. And the source of the violence is a certain ideology, a certain racist ideology, that at its very basic is the idea of the elimination of the native. And as I say, this is not entirely unique for Zionism. There were other European settler colonial movements who definitely were motivated and inspired by the idea of the elimination of the native. So if you look in a very cursory way on that history, you understand that what is really important for ideological movement that is motivated by the idea of having as much of the new land as possible with as few of its native people as possible. You understand that what is really important is the historical period in which it was conceived and the historical period in which it enacted its policies of elimination. Now, if you enact these policies of elimination in the 19th century, as had been done in the United States, you're talking about a world that is quite indifferent to colonialism, to racism, and other human rights, collective human rights, or civil rights. But if you say to yourself, wait a minute, this has been done after the Second World War. It was actually done in the year of the Declaration of Human Rights that the Global North was so proud of, saying to the world after the Second World War, we now have moral foundation that would make sure that the massive killing of people, as we've seen in the Second World War, that racism that we've seen in so many places would be eradicated because there is a moral consensus. When you think in the same year, South Africa issued the apartheid law and Israel exercised the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, you begin to understand the message that both the apartheid regime in South Africa received, and more importantly, the Zionist state received in 1948 from the international community. Yes, we are proudly announcing the Declaration of Human Rights, but we are also telling you it does not apply to you. It does not apply to you. The message from the world was that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine is acceptable, mainly for the reason, I mean, this was the propaganda. I don't think it was the real reason, but it was the kind of saying, in the words of one American intellectual, it was tolerating a small injustice to correct a much bigger injustice. Namely, Palestinians had to compensate the Jews for 1,000 years of European and Christian anti-Semitism. And the deal was very clear, and this is why Israel was the first state to recognize a new Germany. People in Europe and in the West were very hesitant whether to accept West Germany as a member of the civilized nations so few years after the Nazi regime. But the moment they got a green light from Israel that pretended, and not rightly so, to represent both the survivors of the Holocaust and the victims of the Holocaust as the ultimate representative of the Holocaust, they said, we will declare a new Germany, and in return, we want non-interference from the West in what we are doing in Palestine. You would have expected Israel at least to be the third country that recognizes a new Germany, not the first one. But it was very important for them to have this a deal. Also, it also meant that the new Germany provided Israel with a huge financial assistance that helped to build the modern Israeli army already in the early 1950s. Now, when the message from the world was that ethnic cleansing is, in the case of the state of Israel, an acceptable method of national security strategy, it's not surprising that the ethnic cleansing continued. Israel expelled 36 villages between 1948 and 1967 inside Israel. Israel expelled 300,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip during the June 67 war. Israel expelled from 1967 until today almost 700,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And as we are talking, Israel is continuing the ethnic cleansing in places such as Masafir Yatta, the South Hebron Mountains, the Greater Jerusalem area, and other parts of Palestine. Ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian became the DNA of Israeli policy towards the Palestinians, and it employs hundreds of thousands of people to exercise it, because these are not massive ethnic cleansings like in 1948. These are incremental ethnic cleansing. Sometimes it's the expulsion of one person, of one family. Sometimes it's not even an expulsion. Sometimes it's a closure of a village or enclaving the Gaza Strip. It's also a form of ethnic cleansing, because if you create the Gaza ghetto, you don't have demographically to calculate these 2 million Palestinians in the demographic balance between Arabs and Jews, because these Palestinians have no say in the future of historical Palestine. This is the one historical pillar that is necessary for anyone telling us or using this vile language that people are now using against the Palestinians, when people tell us that if we wave the Palestinian flag, we are supporting terrorism. If people compare what happened on the 7th of October in the morning to the Holocaust, and by that totally abusing the Holocaust memory, either they don't understand or they don't know what they're doing. But even if they go with it and take the high moral ground, it's so important to locate this particular event into the wider, distant history of modern Palestine and the particular history of the siege on Gaza that began in 2007. The inhuman siege of 2 million people in one of the longest, probably the longest siege ever on such a large number of people in terms of food, water, freedom of movement, and other basic necessities of life that led already the United Nations in 2020 to think that life in the Gaza Strip is unsustainable for human beings. Already 3 years ago, they thought it was, we already crossed the red line in Gaza. So don't be surprised if when people go out of there, there is outrage, there is revenge, there is violence. Of course there is. There was, same happened with the rebellions of slaves, of indigenous Native Americans, of colonized people from India, through North Africa, anti-colonialist struggle, as I said before, is not a work of Quakers and pacifists. It's can be very violent and can be very peaceful, and much of it depends on how much the colonizer, the ethnic cleanser, is willing to take in the fact that the people that they are colonized or oppressed are not going to disappear and are not going to give up their struggle. The sooner you understand it, the more likely you will have a much peaceful transformation from a colonialist reality to post-colonialist reality. If you refuse to understand it, it will hit you in the face again and again, and the 7th of October is not the last moment of such an event. But there is also another historical context that I would like to bring to your attention. And this is so important because in all this discourse that accompanied the coverage in the media and by politicians in this country and in the West in general, it was very easy to see how people slip over to generalization about the Palestinians, kind of having these adjectives about the Palestinians, a general characteristic of Palestinians. We heard it before after 9/11 about Muslims in general. We heard it during the colonialist period against any people who dared to challenge the empires. There's nothing new in it. But it is important to remind people that Zionism was a disaster that destroyed a Palestine that would have been different without Zionism. This is so important to remind people how Palestine was before 1948. Palestine, where Muslim, Christians, and Jews coexisted, when coexistence was not a fabricated idea of live and let live, but was a genuine way of living together. One should not idealize it. Of course, it had its tension. It has its moment of crisis. But it was a mosaic of life that, particularly in Palestine, was enabled people to also enjoy what the land had to offer. And the land had to offer something you won't find today in Palestine. The land offered an affluence of water, for instance. Only people who remember Palestine before 48 know that every Palestinian village had a stream of fresh water. You know, this Zionist fable that the president of the EU just recently repeated by saying that Zionism bloomed the desert. It's such a fabrication of history. Zionism turned a blooming country into a desert in many places. That is something but you could only do it if you reconstruct with the help of historians the kind of Palestine that was there before 1948, both in terms of humanity and human relationship, and also in ecological terms. The whole connection between Palestinian and herbs, for instance, and nature that Zionism destroyed was part of the quality of life that Palestinian had. Or as the late Emil Habibi put it, when he lived in Abbas Street in Haifa, he said, "I never knew who was a Christian or a Muslim in my street before 1948. And I think this is something that is not nostalgia for the sake of nostalgia. This is an alternative history, if you want, in the sense of telling you that there was a possibility for a different Palestine. And to that history, we should also include the fact that the Palestinian national movement, the Palestinian anti-colonialist national movement, from the moment Zionism set foot in Palestine, in historical Palestine, was loyal to two principles. And this is so well documented that you don't have to work very hard to find it. There were two principles that the Palestinians were loyal to. And particularly, they said it to the Americans because the Americans brought this principle through President Woodrow Wilson to the Arab world, especially to the Mashrek, the Eastern Mediterranean, in 1919. And then the United Nations brought it, kind of repeated these principles. One principle was the right of self-determination for people. The Palestinians said, we also deserve right for self-determination, like the Iraqis, like the Lebanese, like the Egyptians. The second principle was democracy. You know, if you are taking us out of Ottoman rule, under which we were for 400 years, and you want us to decide our post-Ottoman future, what will be our future? What will be the nature of our regime, of our state, of our political existence? We want democratically, by the vote of majority, to decide whether we want to be part of Greater Syria, whether we want to be an independent Arab Palestine, maybe we want to be in a federated Arab, pan-Arab republic, but it's up to us. And every American delegation that went from 1918 until 1948, every international delegation, whether it was Anglo-American, whether it was any other organization, the reply to the Palestinians was that while the principle of democracy and self-determination is cherished by the Western world and they see it as the right pillars on which to build the new post-Ottoman Arab world, it cannot apply to Palestine. Because Palestine was promised by the British Empire to become a Jewish state, and because the Jews are such a tiny minority, the principle of self-determination cannot be applied to the Palestinians, and of course the principle of majority or democratic election is out of the question for the Palestinians. This is also important in the context of our historical journey into the past in order to contextualize the kind of oppression, the kind of history or genealogy of racism that was endorsed and supported by the West when it came to Palestine. Now, this other pillar is not just important in order to remind us what Zionism did or what Palestine could have been. This is the foundation on which we will build a post-liberated Palestine, a post-colonial Palestine. This is the foundation. And think about the elements of this past and how they relate to a different reality from the one we had. And don't let the current attack on Gaza Strip, the genocidal policies by Israel, let you shy away from continuing to think about the liberation of Palestine and how the liberated Palestine would look like. And talk to the Palestinians who are thinking about, not just about the tactical move tomorrow, but who are visualizing. That's what I did with my book with Ramzi Baroud. How we talked to 40 Palestinian thinkers and asked them, how do you visualize a liberated Palestine? And if you look at the way that their vision for liberation, and the vision of liberation, not just how to struggle for liberation, but what will the liberation bring with it? It's all the elements you had in Palestine before 1948. A society that does not discriminate on the basis of religion or sect or cultural identity. A society that respects democracy. A society that respects the principles on live and let live. And more importantly, maybe than anything else, a society that brings back Palestine into the Arab world, into the Muslim world, organically into the place from which it was extracted by force. Now, being part of the Arab world is not an easy scenario for many people, and rightly so. But you cannot be a part of the solution or the more positive scenarios for the Arab world if you're not part of the problems of the Arab world. You cannot have a discussion of human rights in Iran or civil rights in Egypt if you don't include the civil rights and human rights of the Palestinians. There is no point for these discussions because you will always get to the exceptionalism of the Palestinian lack of these rights, and you will always find yourself in an inferior position if you want from the outside to help the Arab world to deal with these issues of human rights and civil rights. And it's only when Palestine, the future Palestine, would be part of the Arab world, that it would be part of its problems, but it will be also part of its solution. I will end by saying just to repeat the main point which I really want to make tonight. There is always an illusion with a dramatic, and it, one cannot underestimate the drama that we are seeing, the human catastrophe. And we are just, unfortunately, I think that we're only seeing the beginning of the human catastrophe that Israel is going to impose, not only on the Gaza Strip, unfortunately, also on the West Bank. They're going to use this as a pretext to change the policies in the West Bank as well. Of course, the most urgent thing is to try and stop it by all the means that are at our disposal in this country to put pressure for an international intervention that put a stop to these genocidal policies that, as I say, I'm very afraid would be extended to the West Bank as well. But part of what we always have to do as well is to strategize for the future, because the basic issues will be here also after this particular moment in time would end in one way or another. And it is this kind of discussion that would ensure, to my mind, that we're not losing our moral compass. We are not deterred by the way people are trying to say to us, surely after what happened on the 7th of October, you cannot keep your old positions on morality. And we should remind people that nobody questioned the right of Algeria to be free, the right of Kenya to be free, the right of India to be free from colonialism, despite any incidents that were there in the struggle for liberation, or whatever level of violence there was there, whatever form the clash between the anti-colonialist forces took place with the colonialist forces. We never questioned the basic right for liberation and independence, and neither should we do this in the case of Palestine. If you want to see a peaceful Palestine, you have to talk first and foremost about a free Palestine. Thank you.
That was a standing ovation for Ilan Pappé, Professor of History, Director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter, UK. Professor Ilan Pappé spoke at the University of California, Berkeley on October 19, 2023. You can find the full lecture and Q&A period on YouTube under the title Crisis in Zionism, Opportunity for Palestine. The moderator of the event was Dr. Osama Makhtisi, Professor of History and Chancellor's Chair at the University of California, Berkeley. The producer was Dr. Hatem Bazian, lecturer at the Department of Ethnic Studies, UC Berkeley. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelaudin. Thank you for listening.